Good evening and welcome. This is the Christian Science Monitor for Thursday, July 24th, 2025. My name is Greg Riddell for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Today's intro is by Krista Case Bryant, editor. As the power and potential of artificial intelligence accelerates, China and the United States are competing for global advantage. But in a way, they're running two different races. China, an authoritarian state, is likely to develop AI applications that increase the Communist Party's control over society, said former Defense Department official Thomas G. Mnuchin at a congressional hearing last month. In the liberal democracy of the United States, American companies seek to develop AI to empower individuals to maximize their effectiveness. Our story today looks at how President Donald Trump seeks to leverage such innovation. Moving to the first story, embracing loose AI policies, Trump seeks edge in U.S. race against China. By Laurent Pelsey. Brushing off concerns about the dangers of artificial intelligence, President Donald Trump on Wednesday announced a set of policies to encourage American private sector investment in AI. The move reflects growing bipartisan concern in the United States that China is rapidly eroding America's lead in artificial intelligence development and application. Beijing's stated goal is to become the world leader in AI by 2030. In a major speech to industry leaders and lawmakers in Washington, the president laid out an action plan that would loosen regulation, expand the infrastructure for the energy-hungry industry, and boost exports of the U.S. technology. America must once again be a country where innovators are rewarded with a green light, not strangled with red tape, Mr. Trump said in remarks at an Energy and Innovation Summit. Mr. Trump's other AI-related initiatives remain controversial, such as eliminating the Biden administration's AI safeguards, as well as banning diversity and inclusion language from the models themselves. He also sided with the companies and against publishers and artists who want to be compensated for AI systems scanning their material. AI advantages in the balance. Still, the threat from China strikes a chord among many AI executives and U.S. policymakers alike. The technology could offer major military, economic, and geopolitical advantages to whatever nation dominates the AI arena. AI built in democracies will lead to better technology for all of humanity. AI built in authoritarian nations will be inescapably intertwined and imbued with authoritarianism, Jack Clark, co-founder and head of policy at Anthropic, told the House Select Committee on China last month. We must take decisive action to ensure America prevails, said Mr. Clark, whose safety and research company builds large-scale AI systems. Artificial intelligence controlled by foreign adversaries poses a direct threat to our national security, our data, and our government operations, said Democratic Representative Raja Krishnamurthy of Illinois in a press release last month, announcing a new bill banning federal agencies from using Chinese AI. The bill has won bipartisan support in both the House and the Senate. To those worried about China's advances, the trends are disturbing. China dominates the competition for patents, receiving 7 in 10 of the world's AI patents in 2023, according to Stanford University's AI Index report released in April. It also leads all nations in AI scientific articles, publishing nearly a quarter of the world's research papers, compared with less than 1 in 10 in the U.S. China has also narrowed the performance gap of its AI models, turning a double-digit percentage deficit in 2023 on some major benchmarks to near parity with U.S. models in 2024, according to the Stanford report. Early this year, a Chinese AI company called DeepSeek caused a sensation by releasing a model nearly matching U.S. models in performance, but using far less computing power and at a fraction of the cost. Share prices of major U.S. AI companies briefly plunged on Wall Street before eventually restarting their march toward record territory. A new tool at work and at home. These super-performing models, called large language models, offer the promise that huge computers can approximate human reasoning and learning. Optimists look forward to those LLMs boosting everything from work productivity to quality of home life. But many worry that smart computers will soon outthink humanity and possibly control it. Mr. Trump is leaning into the optimists' camp, removing some export barriers on U.S. chip and other technology exports, including to China, to a limited degree, under intense lobbying from the U.S. AI industry. The company's worried about lost sales abroad and Chinese AI inroads into global markets. The president also wants to eliminate state laws that might impede AI development and innovation, another major win for the industry. The move against state legislation is controversial, even among Republicans. Earlier this month, the GOP-controlled Congress tried but failed to pass a similar measure as part of the nation's new tax and spending bill. The other priority set by the administration is to eliminate from American LLMs woke speech, such as diversity and inclusion language, which it argues represents a liberal bias in the technology. By loosening restrictions on AI companies, Mr. Trump hopes to supercharge private investment in American AI. Those investments offer a distinct advantage for domestically based AI companies. While U.S. and Chinese government AI spending is relatively close, the American private sector is investing nearly 12 times more than its Chinese counterpart, $109 billion last year versus $9.3 billion, according to the Stanford report. There are other reasons America may retain its AI lead. While U.S. researchers can't match the quality of Chinese research articles, they produce more of the highly cited ones, a mark of quality. The entrepreneurial nature and individualism of American culture may also help in the AI innovation competition with less open China. The race with China. After spending nearly a month in mainland China in June, visiting some of its leading AI companies and its top institutes, Columbia business professor Michael Morris says he has grown a lot less worried about Chinese AI ascendance. "I think the AI industry is way ahead in the U.S., and it's because of the kind of society that we have that allows for this kind of wild innovation. The tension between seeking to win a technology race and trying to protect against AI's existential threats is playing out across the world." The Stanford Index report found that international cooperation on AI governance intensified in 2024, with a large number of organizations releasing frameworks for responsible AI principles. Those organizations include the United Nations and member nations of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the European Union, and the African Union. But this year, the focus on most nations is shifting more toward the AI race mentality, according to a new report by the Atlantic Council, a nonpartisan Washington-based think tank. Some researchers argue that the race is not a sprint, but a marathon, and winning it may not depend on who has the best technology, but how broadly its populace adopts it. Jack Shanahan, an adjunct senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security and a retired Air Force Lieutenant General, wrote in an analysis this week, "Countries that learn how to bridge the gap between invention and widespread societal adoption will reap the most crucial benefits in the long term." And now let's look at some of the latest news briefs. France will recognize Palestinian statehood. President Emmanuel Macron made the announcement in a post on X Thursday amid growing global anger over conditions in Gaza. Mr. Macron said he will formalize the decision at the United Nations General Assembly in September. "The urgent thing today," he said, "is that the war in Gaza stops and the civilian population is saved." The French president offered support for Israel after the October 7, 2023 Hamas attacks, and frequently speaks out against anti-Semitism. Zelensky announced a new anti-graft bill. The Ukrainian president submitted it to Parliament Thursday in a bid to restore the independence of the country's anti-corruption agencies and to defuse tensions caused by his earlier approval of a controversial law placing them under his authority. That move had sparked the first major demonstrations since the war began, as well as criticism from the European Union. The European Central Bank is leaving interest rates unchanged as it waits to gauge the impact of United States President Donald Trump's tariffs. Its board has decided to leave its benchmark deposit rate at 2%. So far, the bank said the economy was resilient, partly due to a series of rate cuts, but that the economic environment remains exceptionally uncertain. Bank President Christine Lagarde said the bank was not committed to any future rate changes and is in a wait-and-watch situation. Zookeepers in Prague care for baby vultures with puppeteers. They're employing puppeteers to save newborn birds rejected by their parents. When a yellow-headed vulture hatched 3 weeks ago, its parents were not ready to care for the chick. That's when the bird keepers placed the firstborn in a box and fed it using a puppet designed to mimic a parent bird. One of the zookeepers said the puppet is needed to make sure the bird will be capable of breeding, which it won't if it gets too used to human interaction. United Health Group confirmed it was under federal investigation. Earlier this year, the Wall Street Journal reported that the Department of Justice officials had launched a civil fraud investigation into how the company records diagnoses that lead to extra payments for its Medicare Advantage or MA plans. Those are privately run versions of the government's Medicare coverage program, mostly for people ages 65 and over. The company says it has started complying with both criminal and civil requests from investigators and is working cooperatively with them. The company's business covers more than 8 million people as the nation's largest provider of Medicare Advantage plans. Britain and India signed a major trade agreement, slashing tariffs. The deal, first announced in May, comes after more than 3 years of negotiations. It will cut India's average tariff on British goods, including cars, from 15% to 3%. India says 99% of Indian exports, including textiles and jewelry, will face no import duty under the deal. Britain expects it to boost bilateral trade by billions of British pounds and create thousands of jobs. Prime Minister Keir Starmer said it was the biggest and most economically significant trade deal Britain has made since leaving the European Union in 2020. Columbia University will pay more than $220 million to the federal government. The agreement was made Wednesday in order to restore federal research money that was canceled in the name of combating what the Trump administration viewed as anti-Semitism on campus. It will pay the settlement over 3 years. The school had been threatened with the potential loss of billions of dollars in government support. Israel received Hamas's latest ceasefire proposal. The militant group confirmed sending the proposal to mediators. An Israeli official called it workable. More than 100 charity and human rights groups warned this week that Israel's actions are pushing Palestinians in Gaza towards starvation. U.S. Envoy Steve Witkoff is expected to head to Italy Thursday to meet top Israeli negotiator Ron Dermer and discuss the ceasefire deal. Conflict erupted between Thailand and Cambodia. The Thai government said at least 9 civilians were killed amid clashes Thursday in contested border areas with Cambodia after the nations downgraded diplomatic relations in a rapidly escalating dispute. The Thai army said it has launched airstrikes on ground targets in Cambodia. 5 Thai soldiers were wounded by landmines Wednesday during a border patrol. That incident came days after 3 other Thai soldiers were wounded along the border. Now we'll leave the news briefs and go back to the regular monitor stories. Next up, Democrats in strong position to retake the House, says campaign chair. By Cameron Joseph and Story Hinckley, reporting from Washington. The Democrat in charge of retaking control of the House said her party is in a strong position to take back the majority, and warned Republicans that they would face blowback if they try to gerrymander their way to keeping power. Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, DCCC Chair, Susan Delbene, a congresswoman from Washington State, told reporters at a Christian Science Monitor breakfast Wednesday that the party is well positioned to net the 3 seats it needs to take power in the 2026 midterm elections. Republicans are looking to shore up their majority by redrawing congressional district lines in Texas to create as many as 5 more GOP-leaning seats, and are eyeing doing the same in other states. Representative Delbene warned that could backfire, predicting that in liberal-leaning states where Democrats have unified control, they'd respond with their own gerrymanders. We're not going to fight with one arm tied behind our back. Republicans should be careful what they ask for, because Republicans are going to lose seats if this is the path that they go down, she said. That's easier said than done. Many liberal-leaning states where Democrats control the majority have laws on the books or in their state constitutions that limit or prohibit partisan gerrymandering. In Texas, she predicted that Republicans could overreach with their map, potentially creating opportunities for Democratic pickups by spreading themselves too thin and turning currently safe Republican seats into new competitive districts. We have incredible opportunity when they start playing with the lines, she said. The Congresswoman is in her second cycle as DCCC chair. In 2024, Democrats gained a net of 2 House seats, even as they lost the White House, leaving them just 3 seats short of a majority. Midterm elections tend to cut against the party in power, and as she pointed out, Democrats have been consistently overperforming in special elections since Trump returned to the White House early this year. Ms. DelBene says, "This cycle has a different intensity compared with the 2018 midterms when Democrats took back control of the House during Mr. Trump's first administration. Whereas that term was more defined by rhetoric and threats to repeal the Affordable Care Act," she says, "this term has seen Republicans fulfill that promise to constrain health care access." When asked if there are particular districts where she sees opportunity, Ms. DelBene referenced Arizona's 2nd Congressional District, where former Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez announced Tuesday he is running again for the Democratic nomination against Republican Representative Eli Crane. She also mentioned the open seat in Kentucky's 6th Congressional District, where the departing GOP incumbent hopes to replace retiring Senator Mitch McConnell, and Tennessee's 5th District, which is held by Representative Andy Ogles, an extreme Republican who underperformed Donald Trump. But Republicans actually have a structural advantage on the map. Currently, 13 House Democrats hold seats that President Donald Trump won last cycle. There are only 3 Republicans in seats where President Trump trailed Vice President Kamala Harris. That limits Republicans' exposure. And recent numbers show Republicans are ahead in fundraising. During the second quarter of 2025, the National Republican Congressional Committee, NRCC, brought in $32.3 million, compared to the DCCC's $29.1 million. But President Trump's poll numbers are sagging, and Democrats have led Republicans in recent polls asking which party voters prefer to win the House. Ms. DelBene made clear that Democrats plan to run on economic issues. Costs and the economy are absolutely number one, she said. And she repeatedly brought up the rising cost of living, the administration's tariff policy, and the GOP's so-called Big Beautiful Bill that she dubbed the Big Ugly Bill. Number one across the board is affordability, the cost of living. Folks are struggling with the cost of housing, food, childcare, health care, energy costs, and that was the big promise Republicans made, that they were going to lower costs on day one. They absolutely are not focused on that at all. Candidates win when they focus on issues that matter to voters, like the economy, said Ms. DelBene. When asked if she was concerned that Democrats would be hurt by being tied to New York mayoral nominee Zohran Mamdani, a Democratic socialist, she said that those in competitive districts near the city have spoken for themselves about their views on the race, while expressing skepticism that Mr. Mamdani would matter much to voters across the country. I don't think that in Arizona or Michigan folks are thinking about who the mayor of New York is, she said. The congressional leader attended the Monitor breakfast as the House prepared to leave Washington for its August recess. After House Speaker Mike Johnson canceled the last day of voting this week to avoid a vote on a bipartisan measure that would call on the Department of Justice to release all its material related to Jeffrey Epstein. Democrats have sought to capitalize on an unprecedented rift in the MAGA movement over GOP promises of transparency around the late sex offender and his elite connections. When asked whether President Trump's handling of the Epstein issue will be a key part of Democrats' midterm messaging, Ms. DelBene said her party would point to it as another example of a broken promise, before she quickly pivoted back to economic messaging. This goes into a string of broken promises, she said, arguing that Republicans had promised to lower costs and stand up for working families, but instead focused on protecting wealthy people in their mega bill. They're breaking promises to protect the well-connected and not focused on the needs of the American people. That's why it resonates so broadly across the country, she said. You're listening to the Christian Science Monitor on Sun Sounds of Arizona, 24 hours of reading from over 200 publications. Next story. Should Israeli military defend Syrian Druze? Israel's Druze are divided. Amid sectarian violence in Syria, in which hundreds of Druze were killed, Israel struck Damascus and issued a warning to the new government. Israeli Druze are mourning the deaths, but are divided over whether Israeli military action is the wisest course. By Leem Halabi and Dina Kraft, reporting from Masadeh, Golan Heights. Linked, arm in arm, hundreds of Druze villagers wearing black and holding the colorful striped flags of their faith marched in slow, steady step together here this week in a communal act of mourning. The march was in solidarity with hundreds of their co-religionists, in some cases their own relatives, killed this month in sectarian violence in neighboring Syria, in the province of Suweida. "The young ones, who were like flowers, are gone," rang the refrain of one of the morning songs. "Our voices are hoarse from crying," says Wafa al-Shar, a peace and human rights activist in the Druze community in Israel, as a new truce took shaky hold in Syria. "But we will continue to shout until everyone hears, until the world understands that this is not just another conflict, but an attempt to destroy an entire community in the land that is their home." For Druze community members who live in Israel, like Ms. Shar, the violence in the majority Druze province of Suweida in southern Syria, the heart of Druze life in that country, resonates deeply. In clashes between Syrian Druze militias and Sunni Muslim Bedouin tribes backed by Syrian government forces, several hundred people were killed. According to the United Nations, almost 130,000 people have been displaced by the fighting. In Druze villages in the Israeli-controlled Golan Heights, a strategic plateau Israel captured from Syria in the 1967 Middle East War and later annexed, family members often live on both sides of the Syria-Israel border, but even here, after Israeli warplanes struck government targets in Damascus and Suweida last week, there are voices both for and against Israeli military intervention, a reflection of the complexities of their identity and loyalties at a time the region is experiencing seismic upheaval. There have been those, including Israeli Druze lawmakers, all three of whom are members of right-wing political parties, who champion Israeli intervention and lobby for even more aggressive moves. Yet others, particularly among the religious leadership, prefer to avoid direct Israeli involvement, says Anan Wahabi, an analyst at the Druze Heritage Center in the town of Yana in northern Israel, and a former colonel in the Israeli army. After the fall of the regime, the Druze found themselves between a rock and a hard place, he says, referring to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's ouster by rebels in December. Like the country's other religious and ethnic minority groups, they have continued to be persecuted and attacked, even though President Ahmed al-Shara, the Islamist former rebel leader whose group previously was affiliated with al-Qaeda, has promised them protection. Call to arms. Netanyahu must overthrow the rule of al-Jolani today, not tomorrow, says Akram Hassan, a lawmaker from the New Hope Party, using Mr. Shara's alias. As a Knesset member and as part of the government coalition, I have directly approached Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to demand the overthrow of the extremist Salafi regime of al-Juliani today, before it is too late. It was during Syria's 14-year civil war that the Syrian Druze community, about 500,000 strong, established its own self-protection units. Some Islamist factions and Muslim scholars consider the highly secretive mystical Druze religion, an 11th century offshoot of Islam, as heretical. The Druze count among their prophets not only Muhammad, but also Jesus and Moses. Historically, the Druze have been loyal citizens of whatever country they live in. The majority live outside the Middle East, in Europe, and around the world, including in the United States. In the region, the largest number lives in Syria, others in Lebanon, and about 10% in Israel. Thousands live in the Golan Heights. Dr. Wahhabi notes that since the Syrian civil war began in 2011, the Druze there have found themselves caught between radical groups, the Syrian regime, and the need to fight for both economic and security survival. He cautions that within Syria, being publicly aligned with Israel is problematic and could further endanger the Druze who remain there. On the other hand, it is clear that Israel is very loyal to its community within its borders. He says the decision of whether to push for further Israeli involvement, military or otherwise, should come from the Druze living in Syria, specifically those from the community stronghold of Suweida, located near both the Israeli and Jordanian borders. As Druze, he says, we do not interfere in the internal affairs of another country, but we will do everything through political, public, and humanitarian means to stop the killing and prevent further deterioration. Israeli strategic interests. Last Wednesday, Israel conducted several airstrikes in Damascus, in one case striking near the presidential palace, and in another damaging part of the Syrian defense ministry. Together with strikes in the province of Suweida itself, the unprecedented military action in the name of defending the Druze took place alongside a direct warning to the Syrian government to withdraw from Suweida. The Israeli government, which has made clear it wants to keep any hint of hostile threats at bay, had warned it would further intensify strikes if Syrian forces did not withdraw from the area, which it considers of strategic importance. By Sunday, Syrian troops began to retreat from the area. The sight of Israeli warplanes in Syria and the damage they caused was in stark contrast to the recent confirmation that Israel and Syria were engaged in official conversations directed at possibly normalizing ties between the longtime enemy nations. Rania Dean, a Druze activist known for her pro-Israel advocacy, is among those pushing for Israel to play a strong role in protecting the Syrian Druze. Israel is the only country in the world that truly knows what the extermination of an ethnic minority on racial grounds is, she says. The Jewish people who experienced the Holocaust and October 7th, the 2023 Hamas attack on Israel, know exactly what genocide is. Israel, in turn, she argues, has a moral obligation to the Druze community. Atrocities continue, and the world remains silent. Israel has a responsibility to help protect us. Next story. Lesotho makes Trump's polo shirts. He could destroy their garment industry. Lesotho faces one of the highest tariff threats lodged by the Trump administration. No one in the tiny African nation could figure out why. By Majerata Latela and Ryan Lenora Brown, reporting from Maseru, Lesotho, and Johannesburg. Long before Donald Trump mocked Lesotho as a country nobody's ever heard of, and before his administration threatened a 50% tariff on its exports, some in this tiny southern African nation already knew the American president's name for a different reason. Trump Golf read the label that workers at Precious Garments ironed into the necks of polo shirts made in the factory, made in Lesotho. Such shirts sell on TrumpStore.com for about $75, about half the monthly wage of the workers who have sewn them. Still, in one of the world's least developed countries, those in the factory's largely female workforce considered themselves fortunate to have jobs at all. Now, their futures hang in the balance. On August 1st, new U.S. tariff rates will go into effect for dozens of countries, including Lesotho, whose economy leans heavily on clothing exports to the United States. But already the threat of large duties is unraveling the industry here. Spooked buyers have canceled orders. Factories are slashing production. In early July, the government of Lesotho announced a 2-year state of disaster. Not Lesotho, it's pronounced Lesotho. I don't have any plan for survival. If the factory closes, says Malaholonolo Makitha, a seamstress at Precious Garments, her voice cracking in frustration. We are a small country that already lacks money. And now this. Unbalanced effects. Lesotho's troubles with the U.S. began in early March, when President Trump declared to Congress that he would put an end to wasteful foreign aid spending, including $8 million to promote LGBTQI+, in the African nation of Lesotho, which nobody's ever heard of. The audience howled with laughter. Then in early April, President Trump slapped the country with a 50% tariff on its exports to the U.S., the single highest rate imposed on any country in the world at the time. That tariff, currently paused for 90 days, was intended to balance out high tariffs imposed by Lesotho on the U.S. The Trump administration claimed, as well as a vast trade surplus, but the effects were hardly felt equally. In 2023, the U.S. sold $7.3 million in goods to Lesotho, a mountainous country of 2.3 million people and 2 million sheep tucked inside the borders of South Africa. Those products, which included dump trucks, vaccines, and used rubber tires, amounted to approximately 1/4,000th of 1% of all U.S. exports that year. Lesotho, on the other hand, sent some $228 million worth of goods to the U.S., mostly clothing, totaling around 25% of all its exports. The 50% tariffs surprised many here, in part because the enormous trade imbalance President Trump complains of was actually by American design. In 2000, the U.S. brought Lesotho into the African Growth and Opportunity Act, AGOA, AGOA, a trade agreement that allowed it to import certain goods tariff-free to the U.S. Quiet revolution. Immediately, Lesotho's small textile industry took off. Kavanagh's factories sprung up in the scruffy industrial suburban of the suburbs of the capital, Maseru. Workers flocked from across the country to sew Levi's jeans and Reebok t-shirts. The vast majority were women, and as the garment industry ballooned into the country's largest private employer, Lesotho became a nation of female breadwinners, a quiet gender revolution built on skinny jeans and polo shirts. "I love what I do," says Ms. Makita, the precious garments seamstress. And she's proud of the life it has made possible for those she loves. Her husband earns erratically as a street vendor, so Ms. Makita's monthly salary of 3,000 maloti, around $170, supports a constellation of family members, including her child, her brother-in-law's two children, and her mother. In recent weeks, however, she and others in the factory have been put on short time, meaning their hours, and wages were slashed in half. Precious Garments, which is one of the country's largest clothing factories, told local trade unions that it has not received any new orders since the tariff announcement in April. Mama Tsaliso Tobilang, who has worked in the factory for 17 years, is blunt about what that means. "We're already poor," she says. "This will only make the poor poorer." A domino effect. On a recent afternoon, chimneys outside Precious Garments belched black smoke, smearing the vista of mountains in the distance. Vendors just outside the gates tempted workers on their breaks with fried dough balls and grilled chicken feet. Meanwhile, dented, wheezing minibuses idled nearby to ferry them home to the cinder block rooms that have sprung up like weeds on the city's fringes to house factory workers. All of these businesses exist to sop up the money coming into Lesotho from workers' salaries, explains Thabo Casey, CEO of the Private Sector Foundation of Lesotho, a policy advocacy group. "If the garment sector collapses, these other sectors collapse too," he says. "There will be a multiplier effect on the entire economy." Although there is no comprehensive data on how the garment industry has already been affected, the country has seen many orders from U.S. buyers put on hold, reduced, or canceled outright, according to Malika Biso Majora, Secretary General of the Lesotho Textile Exporters Association. As Lesotho awaits the final announcement of its U.S. tariff raid on August 1st, it remains unclear to many here what the U.S. stands to gain from imposing high duties on its exports. Ms. Makita has always been proud of the fact that the clothes she sews travel the world and that they are worn by Americans. Now she sees how fragile that connection is. "I am only here hoping Trump changes his mind," she says. You're listening to the Christian Science Monitor on Sun Sounds of Arizona for the Print Disabled. Next story. In Japan, too, voters want their country to be great again. The populist surge on the right is a familiar electoral feature across the West. gains by the far right in Japan show its global appeal. By Ned Temko, London. Japan has often had to face the power, peril, and pain of earthquakes, but this week its national politics were hit by an electoral quake, a breakthrough by a brash Western-style populist party modeled on Donald Trump and his MAGA movement. How that impacts Asia's most stable democracy will become clearer only in the weeks ahead. Sunday's vote was a midterm election for the less powerful upper house of the legislature and the Senseito party, which, while surging, is still only the fourth largest bloc in that chamber. But the message for mainstream politicians and other democracies worldwide is unmistakable. Anyone who has lived and worked in Japan, as I did as an English teacher after college, will understand the extraordinary nature of Senseito's breakthrough. Japan is a country steeped in tradition, where an emphasis on order and politeness and a staid approach to politics has seen the conservative liberal democratic party, the LDP, govern for all but a handful of the last 70 years. The fact that MAGA-style messaging has found fertile ground, even there, on wokeness and the deep state, LGBTQ+ issues and COVID vaccines, globalism, and above all, immigration, has underscored the international reach of this new brand of insurgent populism. It has also provided an insight into why so many centrist politicians in America and across a range of European countries have been struggling to find an effective response. It's that while policies matter, the tougher challenge is to answer the visceral appeal of the populists and to re-engage with voters who feel economically stuck, unhopeful about their future, and unwilling to trust the same old politicians to improve things. Senseito's leap from a single seat in the upper house to 14 seemed less about policy than emotional connection. Its charismatic leader, Kamiya Sohai, did make immigration a focus of his calls to put Japanese people first, but while Japan has indeed been accepting more immigrants to help power a stagnant economy as its aging population exits the workforce, the overall numbers are still tiny by Western standards, under 3% of the population. The power of Mr. Kamiya's appeal and of his party's campaign rested largely on their challenge of the accepted norms of Japanese politics. Major parties have long relied on large-scale campaign contributions, and the LDP was only recently mired in an illegal fundraising scandal. Senseito drew its support from smaller, individual donations. Election campaigns have traditionally featured serious-sounding politicians making serious pronouncements and engaging in serious policy debates. Senseito thrived through YouTube, TikTok, and social media posts, including a hefty helping of conspiracy theories and scare stories around an invasion of immigrants, sometimes debunked by mainstream media fact-checkers, but to little effect. Mr. Kamiya and his party succeeded in positioning themselves as the voice of a wide array of voters united in mistrust of, and sometimes anger at, politics as usual. The online messaging appealed particularly to young urbanites, but the country's stagnant economic performance in the 1990s and early 2000s has also left many middle-aged Japanese discouraged, disaffected, and open to Senseito's norm-busting assault on the established parties. Prime Minister Ishiba Shigeru and his LDP now face much the same challenges as Mr. Trump's critics and opponents in America and center-ground leaders in Europe. How to prevent a populist surge from becoming an irresistible tide. In Europe, the initial instinct of many mainstream conservative parties, especially on the emotive issue of immigration, has been to try to steal the populists' clothes, either by adopting tougher border and asylum policies themselves, or giving the insurgent parties a voice in government. Neither seems to have helped their own political fortunes. Long-established center-right parties have been shrinking as their voters abandon the converted hardliners for the genuine article. The other option, typified by the unapologetically non-charismatic leaders of Britain and Germany, Prime Minister Keir Starmer and Chancellor Friedrich Merz, has been to persuade the electorate they'll work hard to deliver sustainable policy results on issues like immigration and, above all, economic growth in a way that tub-thumping populists simply cannot. On that, the jury is still out. Both leaders will believe they have time to win the argument. However, since their next general elections are still several years away, that may also be the hope of Prime Minister Ishiba, a non-flashy politician in the mold of the British and German leaders who took over the LDP in the wake of the fundraising scandal. Japan's next general election is set for 2028, yet he could be gone far sooner, pushed aside by his party over the ruling coalition's loss of its upper house majority and Senseito's gains in Sunday's election. In the short term, at least, he has vowed to stay. He may draw encouragement from this week's announcement of a tariff deal with the U.S. Its reported 15% levy on Japanese exports is less than businesses had feared. But for Mr. Ishiba and all politicians on the center ground, Senseito's dramatic ascent is a reminder that any effective pushback will have to go beyond individual policy wins. In order to reclaim lost voters, they'll have to match the powerful appeal of the populists with a credibly compelling narrative of their own, that the old-style politics still works and that it can make their lives better. And finally, the Monitor's view. For Gaza and Israel, a push for spiritual diplomacy. When world clergy meet in September, they will bring the power of prayer and interfaith harmony to conflicts like the one in Gaza. By the Monitor's editorial board. Since the Hamas attack in Israel nearly 2 years ago, the Central Asian nation of Kazakhstan has reacted like many other mainly Muslim countries. It condemned the attack. It rejected plans by Israel to displace Gaza's Palestinians. It called for a ceasefire as well as unimpeded delivery of humanitarian aid. And it sent aid itself to relieve hunger. But Kazakhstan has been doing something beyond moral declarations and moral actions, and not just for the Israel-Hamas war. It has deployed what it calls spiritual diplomacy to help quell faith-driven conflicts at their roots by reversing hatred with a recognition of the divine dignity in each person. Located in the middle of Eurasia, Kazakhstan has been a crossroads for major faiths over centuries. Since 2003, it has hosted a conference every 3 years that brings together prominent world clergy, from the Pope to respected Muslim imams. The next one starts in September. These gatherings, called the Congress of Leaders of World and Traditional Religions, elevate faith leaders as an alternative to political leaders in dealing with conflicts. It's critically important for spiritual leaders to weigh in and demonstrate through their example that dialogue and respect towards others must play a larger role in international relations. Bulat Sarsanbayev, deputy head of the Congress Secretariat, told Asia Times, "Spiritual leaders who truly represent a culture of peace are powerful voices in today's world. Kazakhstan is not alone in promoting interfaith dialogue at a time of Israeli-Palestinian tensions. In early July, Israeli President Yitzhak Herzog met with a delegation of European imams who prayed together for the Israeli hostages in Gaza. In March, an interfaith march of Jews, Christians, and Muslims took place in Jerusalem. Don't let people tell you that there can be no peace and that Israelis and Palestinians are forever doomed to be hostile to each other," German Ambassador Stefan Seibert told the Times of Israel during the peace walk. Also in March, religious leaders representing Islam, Christianity, Judaism, and the Druze faith met in Jerusalem for an evening of dialogue. Perhaps it is time for people of faith to step forward. We can rise above crisis to say, "You are not my enemy," even if we deeply disagree, Rabbi Daniel Rowe told the Jewish press. We must foster voices that recognize the divine image in one another and acknowledge that we all serve and pray to the same God. That's it. You've been listening to the Christian Science Monitor for Thursday, July 24th, 2025. My name is Greg Riddell for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for listening. Good night.